You must be doing a phenomenal amount of signal processing on this data.
Yes, yes. This is the hardest part. The hardest part is to take all of that data, which is massive. Most of it is garbage. Most of it is just noise. And to detect which one is not noise and which one is really, really not noise and not something that went wrong with the measurement or with the fiber itself. Which one is not a rat biting into the fiber and not a...
Yeah, these things happen.
They do. They do, unfortunately, they do.
You're listening to Ping, a podcast by APNIC discussing all things related to measuring the internet. I'm your host, George Michelson. This time, I'm talking to Dr. Mona Jaber from Queen Mary University of London. Dr. Jaber is a senior lecturer working on Internet of Things. She's an expert in mobile communication specializing in cellular networks. Since joining QMUL in 2019, she started a new research group that examines the intersection between IoT and machine learning, but in the context of sustainable living. Three research directions have emerged. The first investigates multimodal data, modeling urban mobility. She's using a really novel source of measurement. The second examines data privacy-preserving methods based on machine learning. And the third looks at the digital twin paradigm, a simulation platform for IoT. In 2023, Dr. Jaber launched a new multidisciplinary research lab called the Digital Twins for Sustainable Development Goals. It features a multidisciplinary team and is led by the social sciences. I caught up with Dr. Jaber at the recent APRICOT meeting held jointly with APNIC 57 in Bangkok. She delivered a keynote on these three themes. We're at APRICOT in Bangkok, and our guest today is senior lecturer Mona Jaber from Queen Mary University in London. Mona, welcome to PIC.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm originally a telecom consultant. So I worked for 20 years in the telecom industry. I started my career with the start of the GSM network. So that's a long time ago in the 90s. And this is how I got into this business. One of my jobs was working for a research center in London. At that time, it was looking at the third generation of mobile phones. I was working as a researcher, although I felt I was not equipped to do research. And I enjoyed it. So I thought, okay, I want to go and get my qualifications and make sure that I can do research the way it should be done. So I went and I did my master's and I did my PhD still in 5G at that time. So I was going from
3G through 4G to 5G.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. So my PhD was on 5G and I enjoyed it. One of the applications of 5G was the Internet of Things, where you have devices connecting to the internet, exchanging data between themselves and with the server without a human intervention.
So this is a very nice segue to the keynote, which you have just presented here at APRICOT. It was a talk that's perhaps slightly to one side of the normal presentations you expect to see in an ISP, internet address, technology, peering, BGP meeting. But it's this really amazing space of the applicability of IoT and like devices and sensors to doing things in the real world. So I read three things into this talk. It's a talk about IoT, but it's not only about IoT as we think of small individual devices, is it?
Yes, exactly. It's about the network of devices and about kind of integrating the devices and the network together. So traditionally, we wanted to have, as you say, small hardware devices deployed in various points to sense something about the environment. And then we'd use the communication network, be it the wireless network or the fixed network, to exchange that data. we already have our network for people. This is how we exchange data ourselves. And these devices, which are multiplying very fast, there are more devices than people connected on the planet today. They're using our network at the moment, and it's getting crowded. And we got to a point where we said, do we need to have another network for these devices? Can we use our own network? Can we do something more intelligent with it? And this is where the integration comes into place.
So a context you were setting is also that IoT devices, I mean, consumers might think of them in terms of smart light bulbs or temperature sensors or a Nest doorbell, but actually they have general applicability in industry and in the public space management. They've been deployed as smart sensors in rubbish systems to tell when rubbish bins are full. And your talk was exploring the applicability of IoT to transport problems.
Yes.
But the bigger problem here was that we have a green agenda. And I think you said that a really significant percentage of the carbon burden in society comes from transport.
Yes.
And that component, perhaps 25% of that burden, is something that we could actually manage and understand better through use of IoT.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, I think IoT are key to informing on the goals that we have, green goals. It could be transportation, but it could be many other things. It could be how to manage water, how to manage energy, green energy, various other things. The IoT is that extended vision for us. We could be in our office still, we know exactly what's happening at any point around the earth. And with that information, we can do the optimization. We can really achieve our goals faster. We can see the impact of the schemes that we put in place. Did they really fix the problem or not? Did it look like on paper? It looked like a very nice solution. But in real life, it's not. It's just not working. So this is what IoT tells us. It gives us, it empowers us.
You also highlighted how many of the devices that we use in things like traffic management actually come with their own burden. The rubber sensing pipes in the road that we're all familiar with riding over on bicycles are perhaps the oldest and most simplest. But more modern techniques like using radar, microwave radar sensors, or using video cameras with perhaps motion sensing, they potentially do come with larger risks and cost burdens that have to be thought about, don't they?
They do, especially cameras. Cameras become cheaper now and they're quite widely used. But cameras capture a lot of information. Not all of it is useful for transportation. I mean, transportation doesn't care about the color of my face, about my gender. But the camera captures this data. What do I do with it? There's lots of schemes to protect that data, to do edge processing, but still people don't feel safe about it.
No, you want to have some understanding of the exposure of risk. And what you highlighted in your talk is this absolutely ingenious approach to leveraging a physical property of fiber, optical fiber systems buried in the street. Now, we might do a bit of a deep dive here to talk about the behavior of fiber systems. And please, please correct me if I'm wrong describing this, but fibers send phenomenal amounts of data up in the network layer and at what we would call the link layer in the framed binary data. But the closer you get to the physical layer, these signals are actually super encoded on top of much simpler optical states inside the fiber, driven by lasers. And the whole system depends on internal reflection inside the fiber. So this property emerges that you called an acoustic effect, that if you bend the fiber, you alter the reflection properties of that fiber.
Exactly.
And that is detected in what we might regard as a side channel about the error rate, the bit error rate in the fiber, or in a diagnostic channel that actually exposes the reflectance information. Is that how you are able to see this data?
Yes, some of this is true. What we like about the fiber are various things. As you say, it's a simple device, yet it can carry a lot of information. And what I especially like about it is the propagation loss is very low, which means that that signal can travel kilometers, tens of kilometers.
Without effective loss of the bit signal.
Yes, exactly. The system that we use for sensing is not used for data transmission.
So you're not using side channel in data active fiber. You're using the dark fiber component because fiber is typically laid as a bundle.
Yes.
And the strategy is that you use perhaps two or four strands, but you lay 12 or 18 or 24. And you are able to do optical fiber physics down the other pairs. So there's this acronym, ODTR, O-T-D-R. But essentially, it's a diagnostic mechanism that many of us will know for when fiber breaks, because the abrupt end of the fiber causes a massive reflectance signal, and the exact time your pulse reflected back under the speed of light in the fiber tells you exactly where the signal's coming from. But you aren't breaking the fiber. You're reading this signal in the strain of the bend, but you know where the strain is.
Yes, exactly.
And as vehicles move over the road, you're able to track their movement down the length of the fiber.
Absolutely. So think of a radar. You have a transmitter that sends an optical signal, and it waits to measure the reflected signal. Similar as the radar, it keeps on sending these pulses of signals, and it keeps on measuring the reflected signals. Now, the time it receives the reflected signal indicates what caused that reflection to happen. And what is the location of that, right? So if you send a radar signal and it takes a long time to measure the reflected signal, you know that the object is far, far away. The same thing with the fiber. So we call, depending on the frequency of the pulse that you sent from the transmitter, you have slots where you expect a signal to be received. If you receive, there will always be a reflected signal, always. But if there's no event happening, if there's nothing moving, that is a random noise. And we know exactly the distribution of that noise. When something extra happens, an additional movement, an additional vibration, that random distribution is disturbed and it looks different. We know that something happened and we know where it happened because we know when we received that disturbance. Based on the time of receiving the signal, which does not fit within the random distribution, we know where it is. And we say, something happened there that put strain on that fiber, which caused the reflected signal to be outside that distribution. Something happened.
You must be doing a phenomenal amount of signal processing on this data.
Yes, yes. This is the hardest part. The hardest part is to take all of that data, which is massive. Most of it is garbage. Most of it is just noise. And to detect which one is not noise and which one is really, really not noise and not something that went wrong with the measurement or with the fiber itself. Which one is not a rat biting into the fiber and not a bee.
Yeah, these things happen.
They do, unfortunately, they do.
So you also have been able to construct a machine learning model which can identify specific devices. In your slide pack, you showed how you're using four different vehicles with different axle weights, and you were able to identify a specific vehicle from a known signature. So this pattern is really quite specific. You would know a bus, for instance, compared to a multi-axle lorry. So if we go back to the origination problem, the technique is actually capable of informing traffic management, traffic flow, of really quite significant information about the movement of vehicles on a road.
Yes. So I've seen a commercial application of this system with the industry partner that we work with. And you can immediately tell which one is a very heavy vehicle and which one is not, because the signal that a heavy vehicle produces is much stronger than a small car. That, even if they coexist on the same road, you could see the track of different cars, different trucks at the same time. That's possible. What we did is we wanted to tell exactly which car it is, even if the size and the weight of these cars are similar. We wanted to tell whether there's a special signature. And it is possible. Now, I have to tell you that the experiment that we did was on a small road, and we collected the data overnight. And half of the road was closed, so we really limited the outside traffic.
But these are normal controls with establishing a technique. The basic principle here is that as machine learning improves and as signal processing improves, the applicability of this technique is really quite general.
Yes, yes.
Now, your talk kind of opens the door to the possibility that there's a collaboration potential here between traffic planners and people interested in this component of addressing the green agenda and problems with pollution, and ISPs who are invested in trenching widely in towns, villages, cities to increase density of fiber and will always be deploying more fiber than they use. So we actually can kind of say, rather than having to build out hundreds of IoT devices, you can consider each fiber as an IoT device and perform data collection in the system.
Exactly. This is the strength of the DAS system. We call it the Distributed Acoustic Sensor System, because that fiber gives us continuous information along the length of the fiber, and it can inform these questions. One of the questions we want to answer, we haven't completed the research yet, is can I tell if the vehicle is an electric vehicle or a combustion engine vehicle?
So for things like the London ULEZ zone, where there is a tariffing function against vehicles, you can in effect check compliance to public policy.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we can check the compliance for the ULEZ. We can check the size of the vehicle as well, because in some roads, again, in London, for example, large vehicles are not allowed. We can tell whether it is a public vehicle, say it's an ambulance, that is allowed to go in a place where other cars are not. So these kinds of questions can be answered. Again, we're still at a very pilot trial with a very controlled experiment. Now, if I wanted to deploy this system in real urban environment with lots of other things happen, say that there's drilling taking place.
There's opportunities for confounding signals that are likely to cause problems. But I think this intersection of civil society and public interest and a need for information and the technology base that we operate as network operators, I think this is absolutely fascinating. Keynote presented a third dimension to this story, which I think it would be nice to talk about. You have started a new research group in Queen Mary University.
Yep, absolutely. We call it the Digital Twins for Sustainable Development Goals.
And what is the founding principle here?
That's an interesting question. So there are two principles that led us to start this research group. The first one is, if you want to solve the transportation problem in an urban environment, you have to be aware of how that will impact the economy, how that will impact the health, how that will impact the energy. You can't solve each of these problems in a silo approach, because these are very interrelated.
So this is a kind of overarching goal, that it's an attempt to construct an environment that avoids silos of hard science, STEM subject science, and the social sciences, social policy and governance questions.
Yes.
You're fusing the two plans.
Exactly. Fusing the two. So the digital twin is a place where you could model a very complex system. And this is where we can model each of these layers, the transport, the energy, the health, and various other things, and then bring them together into a holistic approach. So this is the technical side. The other side of it is the research within this lab is led by social science. And the reason we want to have social science leading any research project within that lab is that we need a translation between the owners of the problem, say the transport experts or the energy experts or the economy experts, and the people who will be affected by the solution that we're going to put in place, and then the technologists who are the IoT experts, the AI experts, the network experts. We need a translator between these kind of three different groups, and social science is the best way to do it, where we make sure that from the onset of any research project, we're addressing a real problem as seen by the domain experts. We're including the needs and the concerns of the public who will be affected by that, and we're bringing the best technology solution to address it. So this is what the research lab is about.
I left the UK academic community more years ago than I care to remember. But at that time, the social sciences funding body and the engineering sciences funding body, I don't think talk to each other very much. Yeah. How do you construct a group like this and go and find funding to support this work?
Well, believe it or not, the idea to bring social science was from one of the funders. And
so that's interesting.
I cannot claim that I invented that idea. There was a particular call which a funder across Europe, and the UK was part of it at that time, and it was essential that any project we put forward has to be led by social science. That funder was for transportation. It's called the Driving Urban Transition, and the project was about transportation, sustainable transportation, and public engagement as a main contribution.
I think pretty well anyone listening to this podcast is living in an environment where that area of public policy, how much do we invest in private transport? How much do we invest in public transport? What are the consequences for pollution, for energy efficiency, for society? It's huge. Density, urban density is a big, big consideration. And things like the 15-minute city have become strangely politicized when the actual choice as an individual to choose to live in an environment that has a lower traffic burden. It's amazing. It's wonderful.
I think so. I mean, the 15-city concept is one of those where in some areas the public resists that.
Because it's perceived as a constraint. It's government telling me I mustn't drive.
Yes, exactly.
When it's really just saying if we construct cities in ways that mean you don't have to drive, you reduce the burden.
But
it's been taken in a strange direction.
Unfortunately, it is. And I think that it's not the end of it. I'm a true believer in 15-minute cities because I like to have everything around. I hate to have to put an hour to go and do one thing.
I'll invest in an hour to go to IKEA, but I'd like to buy my fruit within walking distance.
It's kind of
structure. So you also mentioned that you have an astronomical data lake in IoT, a latent collection size of zettabytes of data globally coming from these devices. So part of the dimension of this problem is governance of data. What is the intent of data? What are the privacy risks in data? You're exploring this space?
Some of it, not all of it. The most common way to approach that is what we call the edge computing, where while the data is at the device which generates that data, we do some filtering. First of all, to identify which data is useful, which one is garbage. And more often than not, probably 1 to 10% of the data is useful. The rest is not.
So you reject at source, in effect, and reduce the component that has to flow over the network link.
Exactly. And if that data carries private information, we could do some encryption, we could do some anonymization. One of the projects I work on is with differential privacy, where we intentionally add noise to the data. So if it is intercepted, there's less likelihood.
There's quite an active conversation inside the networking community about structural mechanisms to anonymize IP addresses. And at the crudest level, we just chop a 4-byte structure and randomize 1 byte. But some quite effective researchers in Akamai, Dave Plonker, who's at the University of Wisconsin, has shown that this is really not adequate. And you have to have a more nuanced understanding of the size of random pool you're going to introduce into your data cohort to preserve people's anonymity, because it's so contextual.
It is. And I don't think we have a 100% solution, because at the end of the day, we publish all the methods that we use to protect the data. The hackers don't tell us what they're doing, right? So we're always behind and we're always open, whereas hackers are not. So no matter how much privacy and security you put into protecting that data privacy, it will never be 100%.
So you also talked a certain amount about the energy cost of deploying IoT. That's one of the attractions of fiber as a measurement technique, is the avoidance of masses of small IoT devices. But aside from a power budget, they actually often have a radio power budget. When you were working in 3 and 4 and 5G, was this part of the space you were looking at?
At that time, energy was not a big concern.
So that's a more recent development.
I think the energy concern started with 5G onwards. When we were talking with 3G, 4G, the purpose was the very high data rates and the low latency. That was what we wanted. This is what we designed the network for, and what was still mostly for people. 5G is where IoT started coming in, and we started looking at narrow band for IoT, for example, because IoT devices don't need a high bandwidth all the time.
And technologies like 6LoWPAN, where people are doing packet compression and address compression to reduce the data burden.
Exactly. So I think the energy concern is recent, and people are looking at it at different layers. At the hardware, how can it be energy efficient? At the communication, so how do I make the signal processing energy effective? Which network do I use? Which one is the least energy consuming? Which one meets all the requirements? And it's not a one blanket solution for everything. And I think this is gain, but also it's a problem. It's gain because you have these very diverse requirements, which means that you have that margin to play with, to optimize, and to really make the most energy efficient solution for each one of those solutions. Having said all of that, an IoT device, which is supposed to be a very simple, low complexity device, if I wanted to be a plug and play anywhere, then it has to be able to talk to all possible networks.
So generality has to be built into the chipset, but you're looking to adopt technologies that reduce the energy component, reduce the energy budget in the radio spectrum, in the power spectrum, in the sensor driving. We should be more aware of what it costs us to measure and monitor the systems.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mona, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you for coming and talking to us about this. I would like to be able to post links to this, so we'll have a blog article and we can put people at the URL that will show them your work.
Absolutely. Many thanks for having me, and it was a pleasure talking to you about it.
Thank you. If you've got a story or research to share here on Ping, why not get in contact by email to ping@apnic.net or via the APNIC social media channels. Also, remember the measurement at apnic.net mailing list on Orbit is there to discuss and share relevant collaborative opportunities, grants and funding opportunities, jobs and graduate placings, or to seek feedback from the community on your own measurement projects. Be sure to check out the APNIC website for all your research and community needs. Until next time,